This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you, people who've done incredible things for our sake, motivated by those three simple words, duty, honor, country. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, I think our perspective changes a little bit because we're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This week marks a pretty significant anniversary. May 8th, 2015 was the 70th anniversary of VE Day, Victory in Europe, the Nazi regime surrendering to America and its allies. If you happened to catch a newsreel report 70 years ago, it probably would have sounded just like this.
Jodl, authorized representative of Admiral Dönitz, temporary head of the German government, signs the surrender document. The final capitulation of the Nazi state. So ends Nazism, the scientific organization of all that is evil and bestial in man. Victory celebrations begin at General Dwight D. Eisenhower's headquarters, and Soviet officers join in. The general is presented with the historic pens. London celebrates. The royal family at Buckingham Palace joins in the historic event. London emerges at last from years of darkness, terror, and destruction. In New York's Times Square, and in every city, town, and hamlet, millions cheer VE Day. Freedom-loving people everywhere hail the final decisive victory over Germany.
Yep, that's how it sounded 70 years ago, the voice of Lyle Vann on the news parade by Castle Films. To mark the 70th anniversary in Washington, D.C., 50 World War II airplanes participated in what was called the Arsenal of Democracy World War II Victory Capital Flyover. I hope you caught some of that news coverage. If not, I do have some links for you at hometownheroesradio.com. There were 15 historically sequenced formations representing major battles from World War II, a really spectacular event with all those warbirds. And I was trying to decide what would be relevant to bring you on the radio this week. Sometimes when Mother's Day rolls around, we've had female veterans of World War II on the show. But with that VE Day anniversary, I thought, let's hear from someone who that victory in Europe really meant something to. Certainly it meant something to everybody, but especially to those who might never have regained their freedom if the Allies did not press on to victory. Most of the German prisoner of war camps were liberated in the month leading up to VE Day, but if that victory had not materialized, many of those POWs would have died in captivity. We're going to listen to the pretty amazing story of one of those prisoners, Glenn Schmidt, starting with another date that will never be forgotten, December 7th, 1941. Glenn was a teenager in his native Reedley, California.
It was a Sunday afternoon. A group of us gathered for lunch after church. We went up to Washington School to play softball. And that's when we heard that Pearl Harbor had been bombed by the Japanese. And, of course, at that time, I was a senior in high school, 17 years old. I really didn't know much about Pearl Harbor, and, in fact, I'm sure none of us did.
Did it hit you that this was a huge deal and was probably going to impact your life?
It only took a day or so because the very next day, and was Monday, we gathered together in the auditorium at Reedley High School when we heard President Roosevelt speak to us about the day that lived in infamy.
And how long was it from there until you ended up working for Uncle Sam?
I enlisted October the 1st, 1942.
And was there a reason that you enlisted in the Army as opposed to another branch of service?
I did enlist in the Army Air Corps at that time.
Mm-hmm. With the dream of being a pilot?
No, not really. I didn't know what I would be doing. However, I was, after I enlisted at Fort MacArthur, Southern California, I was sent up to what was then Merced Army Flying School at Merced, which later became Castle Air Force Base.
And you would spend some time there later in the Air Force, long after World War II, but I don't want to get ahead of myself. So you had this thought that you would be in the U.S. Army Air Corps, that you would be far from the front lines on the ground, and I guess, as things would have it, turned out a little differently for you.
It certainly did.
Tell me about that. How did things change?
I became, after basic training, became a link trainer instructor, and being a link trainer instructor, we trained young pilots in basic flying training, learning to fly at night under cloudy and hazardous conditions. That was my calling. I enjoyed every bit of it until an opportunity came to apply for the Army Specialized Training Program, which was a college engineering course.
Mm-hmm.
And after signing up for that, I was sent to Illinois College at Jacksonville, Illinois, for a period of several months, until such time as the need for infantrymen became acute in the Army. And that was all broken up, and every one of us who at that time were college students learning basic engineering were sent to various infantry divisions.
And what was that like for you at the time, realizing it? And here you're in this ASTP program, you're doing something special, you have this great ambition, and they say, no, you're going to be a grunt on the ground because that's where we need you.
Yes, definitely. Well, I had no idea what the infantry would be like. And at that time, I was young enough to accept any challenge. And as a result, I was trained as an infantryman, a combat infantryman, which I was then to become, not knowing that that would be the end result.
Was that difficult training for you? Was it a brand new thing to you? Was it anything you'd had any kind of experience with?
No, sir. Basic training in the Air Force or Army Air Corps was very light, just a couple of months learning how to march step and things of that nature. I was had not fired a weapon in training at all until I became an infantryman. They handed me a Browning automatic rifle, which fired a clip of 20 rounds. The BAR weighed 21 pounds at that time, plus either a bandolier or a belt full of 20-round clips for my BAR.
And how much did you weigh?
I weighed at that time about 145.
So you're carrying around a pretty good percentage of your body weight in extra equipment.
Yes, sir, and 25-mile hikes with something like that on your back, plus a full field pack, I can tell you, is not a very endearing experience.
But it toughened you up a little bit.
It sure did.
And you were going to need it by the time the war was over.
Yes.
Tell me about the unit that you ended up getting assigned to and what your first impression was of the men that you would end up serving with.
I was assigned to the 1st Squad, the 1st Platoon, A Company, the 1st Battalion of the 242nd Infantry Regiment of the 42nd Rainbow Division. That division had been reactivated in July of 1943 and had been commanded by General MacArthur during World War I.
So a division with a lot of history behind it.
Yes, it did.
And not that that does you a lot of good.
No.
When you're up there against an enemy.
No, sir.
What do you remember about heading overseas? You're still a very young man. You've never tasted war before. What kind of things go through your mind when you know that's what you're destined for?
To share this with you, I was married and had a child. He was born when we arrived at Camp Kilmer, New Jersey, prior to going overseas, so I was unable to see him for the first time until I arrived home many months later the next year. Knowing that I was headed into combat with a group of men who really I had just a few months' experience getting acquainted with, we were not combat trained, neither were we that close to one another, because a short period of time had elapsed between the time I was assigned to the organization until such time as we were on our way overseas.
Well, and the very fact that you were assigned to that group was because this was an urgent situation. They needed more infantry people, so you were all kind of just thrown together at
yes,
the last
sir.
Minute.
Exactly.
Doesn't sound like a whole lot of things that could give you comfort or make you feel like you're in a secure and safe situation.
No, I should say that the young man that was assigned to me as an ammo bearer, I lost sight of shortly after we got into combat. I don't know what happened to him. I know he wasn't injured. He may have just taken off. I have no idea what occurred to him. He was from New York, a young kid, about 2 years younger than I was at that time.
And when I hear you say that, I think a lot of people at home probably hear you say that and say, well, you were on your own.
Definitely.
And in a lot of ways, you were on your own, but I know you also felt like you weren't really on your own,
exactly.
That somebody's looking out for you.
I was accompanied by angels of mercy and the gift of the power of the Holy Spirit through being born again as a Christian before I even entered the service during World War II.
And I know we're going to flesh a lot more of that out as this story continues through the rest of the program today. Let me ask you, your first taste of combat, how did that impact you? Did you feel like you were prepared for it? Was it not too jarring, or was it something that just turned your world upside down?
The latter is correct. There is no way to visualize or to rationalize in your mind what might be taking place. Fear sets in. You're constantly afraid. But then again, I was not afraid. It just seemed like I was accompanied by angels of mercy through the whole ordeal. This happened before Christmas of 1944, just south of the city of Strasbourg in France. We had landed the 8th of December at Marseille and rode 48 boxcars to near the line and were dropped off above Strasbourg, but the truck back south, because at that time, von Rundstedt of the German army was tasked with retaking the city of Strasbourg.
Mm-hmm. And Strasbourg would be a very familiar spot for you later in your life, and
yes,
certainly one that's been scarred in your memory because of what you experienced there. What was the biggest thing that got your attention when you did get into combat? What was maybe the most unexpected thing or the aspect of it that was most difficult for you to deal with?
I don't believe you ever get adjusted to the sounds. I heard tanks, American and German tanks. And it wasn't long before I could differentiate which was which. I heard machine gun fire. I could soon tell which side it was coming from. I heard mortar fire. You could soon identify which side was firing the mortars. And artillery fire is entirely different as well. There's nothing like being on the receiving end of enemy artillery. They come in like just a high-pitched scream before they land near, or you don't hear the one that's going to hit you, which fortunately never happened to me.
But you did have some hit pretty near you, and when you see one land just a few feet in front of you, kind of gets your attention, doesn't it?
Definitely. Without question, it does.
And I know you've got some stories about that, some stories about being hit by German machine gun fire, and some stories that I think a lot of you at home today will really be touched and impacted by.
So don't go anywhere unless you're just popping on a device to pull up the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or hometownheroesradio.com to check out some photos relating to today's program. We'll be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.